Morning, friends. That, as you probably know, is the signal to the people in the room next door where they take the different offerings during the week. My name's John Taylor, and I've been asked to share with you this morning some of my experiences over the last 10 years working for the World Council of Churches in the Department for Dialogue with People of Living Faiths and Ideologies, but maybe also some of my hopes for perhaps the next 10 years shifting to a new responsibility in the World Conference on Religion and Peace. We took as the theme for this morning a subject with a question mark that followed it, a wider ecumenism question mark. I put the question mark there partly because I think that we have to live with the fact that the word ecumenical is used in the first instance for that great new movement of the Christian churches of the world seeking together for a greater unity. And ecumenical becomes the adjective to describe this coming together of the churches of many different confessions, many different cultures, many different races, into a sense, a growing sense, of the one body of Christ, a true Catholicity, a true ecumenicity. But the Greek word oikoumene, from which we get this word ecumenical, does in fact point us to a still wider unity. Oikoumene really means the whole inhabited world. And this idea of the unity of the church not just being a private possession or a domestic movement, but the idea of the search for the unity of the church being a contribution towards the wider sense of community and humanity is one that has been with the ecumenical movement from the word go. It goes, if you like, right to the prayer of Jesus, who prayed that we might be one, that the world might believe. And this tension between the oneness and the unity of the church, the body that is called out of the world, but the responsibility of contributing to the whole sense of humanity and community with all our neighbours, a church that is sent into the world, these tensions have to be maintained. And so some of us use this phrase, a wider ecumenism, to point to the sense of responsibility, the sense of vocation, that some of us have at least, to venture beyond our own Christian family, even the enlarged Christian family of the ecumenical movement where the churches grow together, to venture forward into relationships with neighbours of other faiths, of other ideologies, neighbours with no faith, neighbours with no main guiding principle for their life at all. Some of us, as you know, have just been celebrating in person, but I hope that many of us have been celebrating in spirit the great gathering of the World Council of Churches that takes place every 7 or 8 years, that we call the Assembly, the occasion when all the 300 member churches, the Protestants and Orthodox, all around the world, some 450 million, send their representatives, the representatives of the churches, to meet together, to worship together, but also in some measure to plan together for ecumenical tasks in the future. Many of those ecumenical tasks concern the church itself, how we can grow further together in unity. And some of us over this last week have been remembering, particularly inspired by last Sunday's worship, if we've been here as long as that, the way in which growing convergence on dogmatic issues like baptism or Eucharist or ministry are bringing a new sense of blessing to our churches and a new sense of possibility of far more things that we could do together that we have been doing separately. And this isn't only just a coming together to share the body and blood, to share the bread and wine at a great 3,500 strong celebration in a tent in Vancouver. It's also something that happens in a local village or across the street where two churches that have worshipped separately over the years find a new joy in coming together from time to time, perhaps, to share the means of grace. There is this basic task, then, that the World Council of Churches internationally, but the member churches locally have, of seeking for the unity of the church. But one of the emphases that's been strongly there in the ecumenical programs for the unity of the church, one of the emphases has been to balance unity of church with unity of humankind. Now, some people have immediately panicked at a phrase like that and said, this sounds like universalism. And universalism is one of those somewhat emotional words that is used to suggest that we are diluting the particular thrust of the gospel, that we are pretending that everybody is the same, and so on. Of course, people are not the same. Of course, different religions do have very different emphases, even though they also have very significant common ground. But when we think of universalism, perhaps in a more positive sense, it is surely to remind us of that emphatic and insistent strain in our Christian gospel, which is that God is the Lord of all. It goes right back into Judeo-Christian heritage, where we remember that the great promises of God are not just given to us, but they're given to all people. The sign of the rainbow for the whole of humanity. The promises that were given to Ishmael, as well as the special covenant that was given to Isaac, the two sons of Abraham. Then there is, of course, the whole experience of the early church in apostolic times, which wrestled with the fact that it should not just be a private church, maybe a Jewish church, but that it should be a church that was truly one where Jew and Gentile belonged together. And that meant that many of the customs and many of the practices would be very different. That circumcision, which was so important to the Jewish families, would perhaps not be important to the Gentile families. That food laws that were important to the Jews would not be important to the Gentiles. Read about the first council of churches, the council at Jerusalem, and see how the church came, in a sense, to agree to differ on certain of these points. And that, of course, over the centuries, is what the church has so tragically failed to do. We haven't agreed to differ. We've fought over our differences. We've anathematized each other. We've excluded each other because of our differences. Even within the Christian family, how much more have we excluded people outside the Christian family? In the first instance, we're all haunted by the way in which we've excluded the Jewish people, excluded the very people to which Jesus belonged, the very tradition in which Jesus grew up. Which means that we ought to be able to say reverently and accurately, Jesus was a Jew. And yet some of us can't even say that. We have to come to terms with a Christian history which, instead of being a history of including people, has been a history of rejecting people. And the oikoumene, the whole inhabited world, that ought to have been able to recognize each other, that on the day of Pentecost did recognize each other, so that everybody could hear the word of God, the guidance of the Spirit coming in their own language, in their own culture. That wonderful diversity that was a blessing on the church at the beginning began to get lost, and particular cultures, particular ruling groups began to impose a particular set of ideas or dogmas. It was, of course, done with a good intention. The Greek tradition, in providing such a very strong framework for Christian doctrine, was trying to be inclusive, to help to find a sort of common language for the whole church. But in the process, we know that some of the Oriental churches were left aside. The Oriental churches, which are among the very oldest churches, the church established by St. Mark in Egypt, the church established probably by St. Thomas in India, the church that still in the land of Jesus uses the language of Jesus, the Aramaic language that is used by the Syrian Christians. And they parted company with the Greek church after some of the early councils, which instead of being councils to unite, became tragically councils to divide. Later on, the same thing happened on a much wider scale across the whole of Europe, when there was the great divide between the Orthodox world and the Roman Catholic world, when at one side you have a sort of Greek allegiance, though some might call it a Greek captivity, the other side you have a Roman allegiance, some might call it a Roman or Latin captivity. And then we come into this millennium and find the multiple further divisions of the church. Necessary divisions, we would probably say, because certain cultures were being oppressed and rejected and never allowed that Pentecostal freedom to express themselves. But the end of it has been this terribly fragmented Christian church, where we seek for the new unity that Christ can bring. But in the process, for example, of claiming a certain freedom for the Anglo-Saxon culture, or a certain freedom for the Germanic cultures, in the process of which movements like Lutheranism or Anglicanism emerged, then new captivities arose. Captivities related to Northern Europe or to the Anglo-Saxon world. And we boxed the gospel into a particular cultural framework. In the great missionary movement of the last century and this century, the great danger has been that instead of instead of helping the expansion of Christianity, we have in fact allowed all sorts of ambiguous link-ups with colonization, with imperial power, with the overall secular culture of the West. So within the church, we have to come to terms with this. Within the church, we have to try to be truly ecumenical, to allow all cultures their place, to allow all languages their use, to allow all races their equal partnership in the body of Christ. But, as I say again, not just for ourselves, also as a sign to the world. As a sign, let us hope, of promise to the world. Because up to now, the church has not necessarily been a sign of promise to the world. The gospel that was supposed to come to fulfill is very often perceived as having come to destroy. You've only got to look at the indigenous cultures of this continent and of Central America and of South America, and indigenous cultures indeed right across the world, to discover that the history of Christianity is a pretty bloodthirsty and brutal history, where people have been browbeaten or even beaten into becoming Christians. And that is surely so totally against the style of Jesus's reaching people where they were, going to the Jewish people, his own people, as Jews, going to the Samaritan people as Samaritans, accepting the Syrophoenician woman, accepting the Roman centurion. And it's that wider sensitivity to people outside our own family that I think is one of the things that we are learning through the ecumenical movement. Learning it perhaps in the first instance as we find that we can indeed and must indeed celebrate our Christian faith across the races, across the cultures. But then finding that out of that sense of being made fuller as persons by that large and enriched Christian family, we then are given a new vision and a new power to go to those to whom we should be sent, but whom we've sometimes ignored, our neighbours. Now, neighbours very often look like us. Maybe our fellow Christians, fellow Lutherans, fellow Methodists, whatever it be. But neighbours are very often people of another faith. It always strikes me that when Jesus told the story about the Good Samaritan, in answer to the question, who is my neighbour? Because there, you see, was the supreme lesson being taught. If you want to love God, you must love your neighbour. And so the question in the mind of the young ruler who asked the question was, well, if I want to be sure to be right with God, and I'm told I must be right with my neighbour, who is my neighbour? And Jesus told the story of the Good Samaritan. And that must have been a shock to the system of the hearers, that the lesson, the example of the good neighbour, was this person of another faith. And there it is that I think we are sometimes called as Christians to learn from our neighbours. To learn from the Jewish people, for example, how through the most unimaginable suffering in what is for still many of us our lifetimes, and certainly within our generations, how through this unimaginable suffering so many have retained their sense of the goodness of God. It's been living out the whole experience of Job, and yet they've come through it in faith. Not all, there have been casualties, we know. Then there are those other neighbours whom we may have had little chance to meet, but new developments of immigration, of refugee shifts of population, new phenomena of educational institutions becoming infinitely more international, may well mean that for the first time we do have Buddhist Vietnamese neighbours, if not next door, at least in our community. There may be Muslim students in the campuses where we teach, where our youngsters study. There may be Muslim students applying to be paying guests in the homes of our own congregation. Then, of course, there's a sense in which it isn't only the neighbours who are physically within touch of us, but the neighbours in what we sometimes call the global village. The way in which every night when we put on our TV news, we realise that we live in this interdependent world where our economies and our politics are all tied up with perhaps Muslim people who are dying of starvation south of the Sahara, or Southeast Asian people who are struggling with natural disasters in Bangladesh or the Philippines. Our lives belong together in a way that we'd never imagined, perhaps, but where we cannot be excused for forgetting it, because there are so many reminders that come our way. It would be nice to think that religion in the world today was a force for peace, that it was a force for reconciliation. And yet the other thing that we get insistently over our news chains is evidence that far from that, religion can still be manipulated and misused as a force to divide. The Middle East is a classic example. How can it be that the city of peace, Jerusalem, becomes the supreme bone of contention for three religious families, Christians, Muslims, and Jews? How can it be that a country like Lebanon, the land that is also a land flowing with milk and honey, how can it be that a land like Lebanon, which has for so long been a model of Christians, Muslims, Jews, Druze, and others living together, is suddenly poisoned into a series of conflicting ghettos, where the Christians feel that in order to survive, not all the Christians feel that, but some feel it, that they must withdraw to the mountain and make the mountain a little mini Christian state. Other Christians repudiate that and say that is not our Christian calling. Our Christian calling is to live with our neighbours. But some Muslims feel the same. Muslims who ought to be able to live alongside others and respect others, and who have very clear regulations about this in their scriptures, are being pushed by the force of circumstance to think our only way to survive is to separate ourselves from those Christians or those Jews who've exploited us and make a state of our own. And there are other then states within the state, Palestinian refugees giving up all hope of ever having a place to which they can settle back in their homeland, feeling that as a second best they will try and make a mini state in the south of Lebanon, perhaps, or other communities drawn in the same fragmenting direction. And yet, despite that gloomy picture that I paint, it has been precisely the religious leaders and the religious groups, the social workers, the teachers, the medical groups, sometimes organized very officially and obviously by the churches, or very officially and obviously by Muslim humanitarian organizations. It's been the groups like that that have kept a sort of cement still there to bind society together, and have defied public opinion and have crossed the barriers and cooperated with each other and shown that it is possible to love your enemy. It is possible to work together with your enemy. Signs of hope in the midst of despair. Signs that the oikoumene, the whole inhabited world, cannot just be an idea of like-minded or similar people, but must include those who are most unlike us, those whom we find it most difficult to love, those who are technically sometimes our enemies. That brings me back to the ecumenism as a Christian movement too. The World Council of Churches came into being, as you will recall, in 1948, just after the Second World War. And one of the great achievements of the World Council of Churches was precisely at that moment in history to be able to bring together people who've been fighting against each other in a world war. And we have to go on doing that. We have to go on as a Christian group trying to bring genuine forgiveness, genuine acceptance within the Christian family, despite the other political and economic and cultural things that have pulled us apart. But we also have to do it in this sense of wider ecumenism. We have surely today to try to rise to the challenge of relating outside our Christian family to others. And that includes people of other faiths, but as I said at the outset, it also includes people of no faith. Very often we want to stand in judgment on both those groups. We say, but these people have had a chance to hear the gospel, they've rejected the gospel, and so, as Jesus said we should, we shake the dust of their villages off our feet and we go on to others. Or very often we just go back home to where we began. And yet sometimes I really question whether we're right in saying that these people have really heard the word and then rejected it. So often I think that there have been around us people in the secular world, but also people within the other religious traditions, growing up, if you like, within earshot, or even within view of the Christian church, but nothing of the Christian church has got through to them. And why? Very largely because Christians have denied by their actions what they were saying with their mouths, that we've not practiced what we've preached. And we have sometimes unintentionally, but sometimes almost knowingly, acquiesced in a situation where the life the visible life of the church has denied some of the basic components of the Christian gospel. Our churches have been divided on the basis of race or on the basis of class. Our churches have been exclusive clubs rather than inclusive societies. We've also sometimes used a sort of language, or we've jumped immediately into a difficulty of dogma and a complexity of dogma that to me is most unlike the way in which Jesus himself related to neighbours. Jesus very often in his ministry showed a certain reticence, a certain patience with people. He didn't ask people to accept complicated doctrines as to who he was. In fact, at times he even told the disciples not to say who he was, but simply to allow his preaching and his example and his presence with people to do the work. I think we have to find, therefore, a style of being with our neighbours which is much more patient, which is sometimes a silent presence, being with people, suffering with people, staying with people, and not just going and talking at them and withdrawing. Now, I know I've caricatured what the church is doing in that last phrase, but that's what it sometimes looked like. It sometimes looked as if you had to go into the church in order to get the message, instead of the church being a powerhouse from which people went into the world. It's very salutary, it's very saddening sometimes to listen to how a Jew or a Muslim or a Buddhist perceives a Christian. Dialogue with people of other faiths is not all an exhilarating, exciting, interesting engagement. Some of it is a desolating engagement. To realise just how deeply the Christian church can be misunderstood. But is it small wonder that it's misunderstood like that? Put yourself in the position of being a Jew who for two millennia has perceived the church as an oppressive, arrogant, destructive force vis-a-vis Judaism. Put yourself in the position maybe of a Native American, one of the indigenous people of this continent. Go around the museums here on the West Coast and see documented the way in which the churches in the first instance, the Catholic Church, the Presbyterian Church, the Lutheran Church, simply destroyed people's cultures, forbade them to have their hair long or to wear particular clothes, or forbade them to have sacred areas in the forests or by the rivers, forbade them to honour the burial grounds of their ancestors. And realise that that has left a deep wound and a deep scar. So when we go to our neighbours of other faiths, we don't just go in a spirit of bonhomie, of let's be friends. Least of all do we go in a spirit of condescension. Here we are with our Christian gospel, come to share it with you. Very often we have to go to those neighbours in the first instance with a very deep and real and visible sense of repentance. Because maybe not what we personally have done, but because in the body of Christ we have a shared sense of responsibility for what's happened. If we really believe in the communion of saints, if we really believe, and I think actually it's a very good scientific notion that we do belong genetically to a past as well as having an investment in a future. We belong as Christians, most of us, to a culture that has these very dark pages of destructiveness. We can't reach our neighbours credibly unless we repent about that. The amazing thing is that the neighbours are very often ready to meet us. It embarrassed me at the night at the Vancouver Assembly we invited 15 guests of other faiths. There were these virtually 3,500 Christians. And we invited 2 Jews and 3 Muslims and 4 Buddhists, a Sikh, a Native American. These people had the grace to come. Although they were so few, and quite a few others came in from the town day by day as visitors, not just as visitors, in fact some came as volunteer workers. There were Jews and Muslims and Hindus working in the assembly every day as volunteer workers. It moved me very much and made me wonder how far we as Christians would be able to participate in that gracious, almost anonymous way in a gathering that was the gathering essentially belonging to Jews or belonging to Muslims or others. But these guests, for example, some of you may want to read what they offered to the assembly as a message, the meaning of life. These guests brought not only a willingness to be with us and a willingness to listen to us and all the graciousness that that implies, but they also brought a message to us. Because so often the concerns which are the Christian concerns in today's world are also the concerns of our neighbours. This may be at the level of the very human problems of struggling together over the generation gap, young people relating to older people, courtship problems, especially maybe in very particular issues like mixed marriages, the role of women in society, the issues of education. How can we learn about each other's cultures? Another document I'll make available to, if any of you are interested, Christians and education in a multi-faith world. Do we have to go on bringing up our Christian generations in almost total ignorance of what Judaism or Islam or Hinduism or Buddhism really means? If we have a strong Christian faith, doesn't that give us sufficient strength and maturity to understand something about our neighbours, just as we would like our neighbours to understand something about Christianity? Concerns for justice. Here's a report of a conversation we had with Hindus on how to bring about justice in society. And there were difficult, thorny questions to raise here. In the case of the Hindu world, there was the whole question about the division of society into castes. But in the Christian world, there was this spectre of a Christian church that has been so often racist or divisive. So often when we've come into a situation of sharing with each other across our different religious frontiers, I'm getting that fly, it's the last thing I do. there are limits to dialogue. And flies. With all due respect to Albert Schweitzer. So, back to the subject. When we come to a dialogue with our friends, we do face some real difficulties. Difficult, thorny subjects like this one, of what justice really means in a society conducted around caste or race. And then there are the other major issues that we have to tackle together, I believe. Major questions like peace. How can we, in a world that is divided and in conflict, sometimes even in the name of religion, how dare we hold up our religions as signs of peace or shalom or salam or whatever it be? Because one of the great damning indictments that lie against us as religious people in the secular world is that so many good, peace-loving neighbours say we don't want anything to do with religion because religion divides, because religion separates partners in a marriage, members in the same village, members in the same tribe, because religion is a pretext for warfare or adds fuel to the flames of war. And it's no use just shrugging off these accusations. At the same time, we have to be fair. We have to be fair in dialogue with each other as religious people, but we also have to be fair in dialogue with the secular world. One of the main rules of the game, if we can call it that, that I'd like to mention, is that when we come to make comparisons, we make fair comparisons. We compare ideals with ideals and failings with failings. We don't hold up as Christians some superb Christian ideal about living in peace and then contrast that with maybe the present policies of Mr. Begin and say how superior, therefore, Christianity must be to Judaism. We realize that there is just as much yearning for peace, just as much commitment to shalom in the Jewish community, regardless of what certain administrators may be doing. And then when we come to compare failing with failing, we realize that the failings which we may be so quick to criticize in the neighbor very often exist right back at home as well. Again and again I come to that word of Jesus about not looking at the mote in the other person's eye until I've come to terms with the beam in my own eye. And again in Christian history and in our own personal lives, there are beams. We have to come to terms with those. Peace as a subject for bringing people of the different religions together is, I think, a very promising one. Even in the most difficult situations, and I'm thinking now of the situation of the church in the Soviet Union, there have been extraordinary achievements within recent years. And some of those have been the great conferences for religion and peace, which the Russian Orthodox Church, I remind you, the largest member church of the World Council, and therefore one with the smallest voice in terms of our proportional representation rules. It's one of the paradoxes that the bigger a church is, basically the fewer delegates they have per person, per communicant member. But the Russian Orthodox Church, which for a while has been lying low in the ecumenical movement, is more and more coming to make a very valid contribution. And one of the valid contributions it makes is in this sounding of a voice for peace. And they're not only doing that in Vancouver or in the international meetings or at Geneva. They're doing it at home. Their ecumenical commitment is an ecumenical commitment that starts at home. In recent years, relationships have been transformed within the Christian family in the Soviet Union in terms of new working relationships with the Baptists, with the pockets of Methodists, with the Pentecostalists and others. The human rights concerns of the Baptists or the Pentecostalists are now lifted up regularly by the Russian Orthodox Church and transmitted to the authorities. The thing I want to underline a little more is the way in which the Russian Church, which so far has always, in a sense, struggled and labored under the responsibility of being the official church of the country, going back, of course, to Tsarist days and before, has suddenly come to terms with the fact that it is one religious force among others in the Soviet Union. And so the conferences for peace, which they have organized in the Soviet Union, have been done together with the estimated 50 million Muslims in the Soviet Union, together with the many millions of Buddhists who live particularly in Asiatic Russia, together with the small numbers of Jews who live in Russia. And they have had these inter-religious conferences which have made an extraordinary impact upon the society of the Soviet Union. They've been an embarrassment in many ways to the government, because the government has been unable to control this groundswell movement, this yearning for peace, but peace not just in a sort of negative sense of absence of war, but peace in a very positive sense of really building up visions and commitments for peace. Some of it, of course, comes very specially out of the life of peoples who've seen what war is really like, seen what it's like in the past, in the devastating destructions of the Second World War, but seen what it's like through the whole of their present lifetimes, where, in the same way as happens in other societies, such grotesque proportions of national expenditure go on military expenditure. Here, maybe in North America, back home for me in Northern Europe, we're protected from that because we still go on having a high and ever higher standard of living. But we should never forget that the expenditure that we also allow ourselves, not only on our consumerism, but also on our military consumerism, is at the expense of others. And as we've been reminded again and again this week, the costs are paid not by us, but they're paid by those who are dying of hunger in so many parts of the world. Now, peace understood very positively, peace understood as more than just an absence of war or an absence of militarism, although that strict disarmament work has to be part of the agenda. Peace understood as a real fullness and wholeness of life becomes, I think, a new catalyst for human beings to come together across their different frontiers. We've lived all these millennia in separate religious ghettos, and yet within some societies there are real experiments of multi-religious and multicultural coexistence. I think you can see it in some of your North American cities. I've certainly seen it in Canadian cities like Toronto and Vancouver, where at least in intention there's a whole new direction to education, a whole new sensitivity in the churches, a whole new activity going on, where people of different religious communities are finding things that they can do far better if they do it together. Peace movements that draw together Christians and Jews and Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists, the Hindus bringing their special perspectives on non-violence, which have so captivated us all as we've seen the Gandhi film, the Buddhists bringing their perspectives of a peaceful society where the priorities are, in the last instance, the priorities of the spirit, but not at the expense of the body politic either. And the Jewish people, through all their past and present tribulations, with a distinctive contribution to make to our ideas of peace. How can we realize more of that? Not only, I think, at the top level, because although I, for my sins, have had to work with international organizations and shall continue to do so, I am convinced that we cannot, with any integrity, work at the international level unless it's responding to what's happening locally. The dialogue that I've been talking about is not just a job for professors of history of religion. You don't have to know Arabic to talk to a Muslim. You don't have to know Hebrew to talk to a Jew. You don't have to be a theologian to talk about theology, to talk about prayer, to talk about suffering. The real dialogue that's happening is very often the dialogue that happens maybe in a Tanzanian village where Christians and Muslims have been moved in by government policy, suddenly find themselves side by side, and find that they do need to talk together about the deepest things of the spirit, as well as shoulder together the same yoke in terms of the practical jobs that have to be done, and share the same ideology in terms of the political commitments that have to be made. A lot of local level dialogue can happen on university campuses. The way in which I myself came to a first awareness of the claims of Islam was when a Muslim student came and knocked on my door and said to me, I'm president of the Muslim Society, I gather you're president of the Student Ecumenical Society. Could we meet sometime? And we'd like to know more about Christianity, and you might like to know more about Islam. It never occurred to me as a Christian that I should be interested in the children of Ishmael. But here was this challenge coming to me from my neighbour. So, at many levels, and it's for you to find out what the level is, it might be the level of women's concerns. There have been some very interesting experiments, and more than experiments, achievements recently, where Christian and Jewish and Muslim and Hindu women have come together, maybe in the first instance with what some people might regard as a feminist agenda, but which is really a human agenda, an agenda where women together with particular perceptions can say things. Then there are the youth dialogues. We've done some of those under World Council auspices to make sure that our World Council programs are not just out there, but also have the feedback possibility to the new generations. There are the concerns for education, the concerns for peace that I've mentioned. One thing I'd like to say in conclusion is, though, that none of this dialogue just happens. Well, some of it happens, that's true. Some of it is a natural human living together. But basically, I think we have to work for it. There are so many forces that militate against it. There are so many pressures to keep us apart. There are so many temptations just to stay as we are in our own little cozy club, that it really involves a certain intentionality to say, now, what does it mean to be a church in the world? Who is my neighbour? Have I looked far enough, or have I sometimes even looked close enough to see who really my neighbour is? What potentialities are there for building neighbourhood? And if we're building neighbourhood, if we're loving our neighbour, then we're going back to fulfil the first commandment, which is to love the Lord our God. Thank you. Questions. I'll just hold up a few books. First of all, ones that are in the bookshop. I remind you that there has been in the Holden bookshop some of the more popular material about the World Council, both its work among the churches and beyond the churches, Acting in Faith, this, I think, attractively written, popular account of the World Council's activities. This one, The Feast of Life, which is a more meditative book and a more theological book, but which helps to pull the strings together. And then this one, which is really just a rather experimental study group background raw material book, published in fact as 8 little pamphlets. So you can just take one particular pamphlet along for a study group. And a lot of these issues are addressed here. The issues of living together in community, the issues of interfaith work, the issues of education, peace, justice, church unity, and so on. Anybody who wants the much more official report, that's also available for inspection. Nairobi to Vancouver, Nairobi being the last General Assembly, and Vancouver the one that's just completed. And then in the bookshop also, there's this small study guide called Guidelines on Dialogue. And this is one that tries to answer some of the theological questions. Why should we, as Christians, have this sense of vocation to relate to people of other faiths. Guidelines on dialogue with people of living faiths and ideologies. It's still a hot potato theological subject in some circles. Some people are really frightened of dialogue. And this came out of a lot of ecumenical work, the Protestants and Orthodox and the Catholics working together. And this is an official World Council position paper on that subject. Others may want to know a bit more of the nitty-gritty of what goes on in a dialogue. I have a few copies here of, for example, a report that came out of a meeting with Muslims, where we talked together about how, as human beings, we can address some of the big problems like refugees, or world hunger, or world development. These are some of the practical things we discuss. And then the ones I held up, the example of the Christian-Hindu dialogue, the educational dialogue, and then this reflection by the guests of other faiths at Vancouver. On the cover, you notice a native Canadian from the Ojibwe tribe holding his raven feather, and the author of a very beautiful prayer, which comes at the end of the report. Any questions?
Where I live, ecumenism suffers a little bit. It doesn't seem too credible to people, but I have an idea. Inasmuch as most of the non-like us people whom we meet are either evangelicals or fundamentalists, why don't we declare them non-Christians? And then we can begin dialogue with them. Seems to be a reasonable idea.
Well, one thing I would like to say is that I see what you're getting at, and there is a very important issue here, that it's no use just being ecumenical in your little ecumenical club. You have to face the realities of the church and the realities of the world. The realities of the church include many people who have serious misgivings about ecumenism, and they very often call themselves evangelicals. Many of us would like to call ourselves evangelicals as well, and many of them would like to call themselves ecumenicals. But what I want us to perhaps to get away from is any sort of dialogue which starts by describing the other person negatively, by describing the other person as a non-this or a non-that, a non-ecumenical, let alone a non-Christian. The Vatican Secretariat, which is the parallel program of the World Council one, calls itself the Vatican Secretariat for non-Christians. And they've suddenly become very embarrassed by that title, because they realize that they wouldn't like to be described themselves as non-Buddhists, or non-Jews, or non-Americans, or whatever.
Have you ever heard ALC, LCA, and AELC Lutherans talking about the Missouri Synod?
Well, this is part of the problem. That, I mean, one thing that happens very often is that if we perceive another group as a somewhat sectarian group, as a somewhat exclusive group, as a somewhat intolerant group, that's a very infectious thing. We can very easily get contaminated. Yeah. And as soon as we ourselves take on any sectarianism, that's the end of the dialogue. I think, you know, it goes back again to the mote and the beam business. We cannot rule out people as partners for a dialogue. We have to be open to all our neighbours. On the other hand, there may come a point when the partner, or the potential partner, is really saying to us, I'm not interested in a dialogue. I believe that I am right. I believe that I possess the truth. And perhaps that is a time for shaking dust off feet, at least not in a very rejecting sense, but in a sad and disappointed sense. The problem is that sometimes people give that impression of aggressiveness or intolerance to us as a defense mechanism against what they perceive to be an aggressiveness or a triumphalism in us. That if we go into a dialogue essentially trying to manipulate the other person will see through us very fast. A lot of Jews will not come to a dialogue with us because they think we're just trying to use the dialogue to sort of soften up the ground and then get in when the soft underbelly is revealed. So we have to be we have to be very self-critical, as I said before. The dialogue, in summary, must address itself to some of the toughest questions. Within the church, I would fully agree that this division between ecumenical and evangelical has to be addressed. It was one of the great things of the Vancouver Assembly that it was addressed. It was one of the great things of the Vancouver Assembly that we really did come to listen to each other and love each other and worship together. I hope we can stay with that as we go on.
Could you give, for instance, some examples how the people of other cultures and faiths see us? Probably it's very difficult for us who for years have thought of ourselves as surely the examples of the world which everyone will want to imitate. And to hear that somebody else sees us a little bit differently. Could you give us an example of how some of these things, that how do others see us?
I already gave the instance, for example, of the indigenous peoples, the native peoples, who've seen Christianity coming in to, as I said, destroy rather than fulfill. I gave the example of the Jewish people who think of Holocaust and Inquisition before. But very often it can be a more intimate thing than that. It can be the style of a Christian teacher in a school. A Christian teacher who, instead of, so to speak, offering the elements of the Christian gospel, is almost imposing them, is pressurizing people, at worst is even brainwashing people into a form of Christian acceptance. Now that makes for a lot of negative reaction. I think too that one of the areas where the church has failed most tragically is with the poor. This again was one of the major features of the Vancouver Assembly. The way in which we tried in penitence to recognize how far the church has moved away from really believing the beatitude, blessed are the poor, both the poor in spirit and the brokenhearted, but also those who have to struggle and do struggle with material poverty. We have to learn a new expectation about what we can learn from the experience of the poor, but also we have to learn a new sense of identification with the poor. And that's easier said than done, I would be the first to admit. The church is so often perceived as a church of power and wealth and prestige. And there has to be a lot of dismantling. There has to be a lot of pruning if we are really to come back to that level of credibility with the poor of the earth. Now, this is not to say that we have to tear down our organs and whitewash away all the guilt and so on, because the poor are typically those who will most relish and appreciate some of the beauty that we see in our medieval cathedrals or that we see in our exciting modern churches or whatever. But a church that uses that as an excuse to luxuriate in certain inherited riches and accrued riches is a church that is leaving the majority of humankind on one side. The majority of humankind are poor. And if we believe the gospel, we have to believe that that's a gospel that is relevant and appropriate to the poor. So we talk about appropriate technology and so on, but by Jove, don't we need appropriate theology and appropriate liturgy and appropriate Christian presence with people, ways of sharing people's life and suffering and hopes and fears.
What has made the success of the missions in the African areas? You talk about the problems of the indigenous cultures and the problems that exist in some areas of the world, and it, from the reports that I've read from our missions, things seem relatively successful there,
yeah,
as opposed to other areas. What was done different there, or is it just the culture that happens to be there that was more accepting to the outsiders?
I don't think one can generalize about this, but I think one of the undoubted elements, one of the undoubted reasons for the rapid expansion of Christianity in Africa is that there was already a deep spirituality in Africa. I think it's a total misunderstanding to think of Africa as a great spiritual vacuum into which the Western missionaries came. Africa was and is a deeply spiritual continent, with a people like the indigenous people of North America, with that sense of the sanctity of life, of also animal and vegetable life as well as human life, a vivid sense of the world being spirit-filled. And it's a bit like Paul at Athens. It has been a declaring to people of the unknown God. It's been a declaring to people of the God who is indeed creator and present through every fibre of society. And very often it has been a presentation made by missionaries who have identified closely with the people. Not always. I fully concede that there are many examples of a mission which have been aloof from the people, which have been a compound mentality, separate from the people, but there has been a great deal of sacrificial identification with people in the missionary movement in Africa. This goes very strongly in Catholic missions as well as in many Protestant missions. And so there has been that element of lives as well as words speaking to the people. But let us never forget there is also the other side of the coin, where other lives are denying the presence of Christ and the equal grace for all. And this is where the church in Africa is in fact poised, I think, in a very dangerous moment, because while there has been this massive Christianization of the continent, though not as massive as we'd sometimes like to think, there is also a very clear phenomenon of turning away from established churches, some of it in a healthy direction. Some of the African independent churches are perfectly sound at every level, but some of them are ambiguous, and some of them are almost moving back into what we might call a sort of neo-pagan revival, and some of them are even breaking away and becoming anti-Christian. This is not, I think, a cause for massive condemnation upon those independent breakaways. It's a cause for great introspection and self-criticism in the churches. Why is it that some people who, having come into a Christian fellowship, then find that Christian fellowship is phony and are forced to go off and experiment elsewhere? Let's not forget, too, that parallel with this massive Christianization of the African continent, there's been an Islamization of the African continent. And it's still very much a moot point as to which group is growing faster and which group is spreading faster. There's a lot of jitteriness among a lot of Christians, but Islam, with its new material potential for building schools, clinics, and so on, is going to represent a real challenge. But sometimes Christians made an appeal precisely because of the educational and the medical offerings that they were making, and only secondarily through their spiritual offerings. No simple answer, therefore, as to what's happening in Africa, but once again, a tremendous cause for us to deepen our understanding and deepening our involvement in the prayer support of these situations. Because in the last resort, all this dialogue is not just a dialogue between us as individuals. In the last resort, it's a way of recognizing Christ in the neighbor, of seeing Christ in the brother and sister, and therefore the whole privilege of being human, the whole privilege of belonging to so many different races within the one Christian and the one human family means that we need to use that privilege to refocus again on God and to meet Him in the dialogue. Thank you. I think the bell for lunch will be about 8:00.